this is my weekly podcast, Adventures with Postpartum Depression, a show dedicated to sharing stories and spreading awareness about maternal mood disorders. For show notes and more information, please go to my website, ppdadventures.com. There's also a Facebook page, facebook.com/ppdadventures. And now, on to the show. Hello, adventurers. Welcome to episode 40. I can't believe it. This podcast is 40 episodes old. That feels ancient. Not even a year, but still 40 episodes. That's awesome. This week, we are going to talk with Sandy Solaro. Sandy, I feel like I just butchered your last name. I'm so bad at pronouncing names. Bad at pronouncing words, but last names, my God. And if you hear banging around in the background, that is Master Julian, who is not napping today at the time that he should. I signed Pippa up for some extended care until 2:30. It's 1:20 now at our house. He should have been napping, 2 hours ago. But he's not napping today. So probably teething. You could practically see the molar. Like, there's just a tiny last bit of gum over it. So that molar is making a final push. The kid still has like 12 teeth, yet the molars have decided they're coming in before even some of the very front teeth. So, all right, whatever. Babies are weird. So Sandy is the author of the postpartum depression memoir, Dancing on the Edge of Sanity, which is by Anna Claire Rouds, a pen name. And we'll be talking about that a bit. I forget if we talk about it in this episode or the next, because I'm going to be breaking Sandy's interview into two episodes for you. And the first episode will be Sandy's story, the 45-minute or so version of what happened to her. And then if you want to know more about it, I would really encourage you to go read her memoir, Dancing on the Edge of Sanity. And then in the second interview, which we'll have up next week, we get a little more cerebral, talking about the process of writing a postpartum depression memoir. Wow, Julian is really going after some cabinet, and he's swinging it back and forth, and I know what he's doing, and he's going to make such a mess. And that's the thing. You have to neglect the housework, and maybe neglect the children a little if you're going to get anything done. I'm not talking about criminal neglect or even the sort of neglect that, you know, happens on TV shows that, you know, get the kids in foster care. I just mean that, okay, right now I'm sitting at the kitchen table and I can see the following things on the floor. Okay, a broken toy ambulance from Doc McStuffins, a toy car, ripped up pieces of cardboard that were used to make a parking garage toy that lasted all of like 5 minutes. Fuck you, Pinterest. A ripped up Cheerio box that actually worked as a tunnel, some magnet blocks, Pippa's Minnie Mouse backpack, another toy car, this one has Elmo in it, a dirty towel just on the kitchen floor, hello, a ball, a Lego block, a pan lid, a pot lid that Julian took from the cupboard to use as a drum, and if I turn my head another 45 degrees, I can see the front room, and we are not going to talk about the front room because it's not even just toys. There's dirty plates. I had the most wicked PMS all weekend. It was like PMS colliding with like a little bit of a virus that seems to be kind of affecting my throat and maybe, oh, Julian, honey. Oh, I thought he had a pen that he's chewing on. Oh, okay, you can play with that. And yeah, do you want to come say hello? Are you just going to kind of stand there and chew? He's here, he's watching, he sees the microphone. Yeah, Mama's talking, doing her podcast intro. So, yeah, just wicked PMS. And my PMS has definitely been worse since I started weaning off Zoloft late December. So maybe it's just that. Maybe my body has changed since I had kids, and my psychiatrist was saying I might need Zoloft the week prior to my period to deal with hormonal fluctuations, that some women only take Zoloft for 1 week each month. They don't need it full time. So maybe that's me. I don't know. We're finding out. I am was down to 50 milligrams, but yesterday and then again today, I took 75, and I think I'll take it again tomorrow. And no, I know I will take 75 again tomorrow because this is an adventure and it's a process. And you can go online and you Google like Zoloft withdrawal.
Please.
Yes, though, please. Those are stickers. You can play with the stickers. Yeah, just take them off. And do you think Rush Limbaugh ever takes his kids to the studio? Actually, he does not have kids. And this is not, definitely not, the Rush Limbaugh show. This is Adventures of Postpartum Depression. And sometimes kids come into the studio, which is a dirty kitchen table. Yeah, you think mama's microphone's cool? Okay, so maybe we shouldn't have a really long intro this week since I am just coming back from the darkness of PMS. Was so excited when my period arrived this morning because I knew then I would the darkness would be washing away. Just you know, the feeling like you're crawling out of your skin, and you really, yeah, I know you think the microphone's your toy. You're very cute, but you're not ready for podcasting yet. No, it's not a toy. It looks like a toy. Not actually a toy, baby. You can say something. I'm sure people would like to hear from you. Yeah, they know that we're not waking. Here, let's give them some animal noises. Julian, what does a monkey say? Yes, and we hit the chest. What does the cow say? Yeah. What does a goat say?
Meh.
Yeah, meh. And what does a duck say?
Quack.
Quack, quack. What does a cat say? You thought I said cow. What does a cat say? A kitty cat. Meow. Yes. I think that's enough animals. He does know, I think, a few more. I always forget. So, anyway, I'm going to turn it over to Sandy, and we're going to hear from her again next week. And I have so much more I could say about her, but Julian's like trying to rip the microphone away from me. And if I don't get this recorded now, it's never going to get recorded. But anyway, me and Sandy, we did meet. Oh, Julian. He like just hit all the keys on my computer screen. This is just such an adventure. I wish I had like a video of this to post on YouTube for you. Up. And now he's standing on the kitchen table. But me and Sandy met at the Warrior Mom Conference, and she led a Zumba class that I took. So I did know get to know Sandy before and this interview, but I look forward to getting to know her more. And I've loved getting to know all of you warrior moms out there who've emailed with me and who want to be on the show. It's just so wonderful to see that more and more people are listening to the show. And I mean, I hate that it's a necessary show, but I'm glad. I know that it is, so I'm glad that the right people are starting to find it. Okay, we're gonna say bye-bye. Can you say bye-bye, Julian? Bye-bye. You waving to everyone? He's waving. And let's give it over to Sandy. Hi, Sandy. I'm so excited to have you on the show today.
Thanks. Hey, Courtney, I'm so excited to do this with you.
All right, well, I obviously know like so much of your story because you've written a book and I've read it, and I know everything from the moose to your escape from the psych ward. But why don't we give a little overview of your story for those who haven't read your book yet? And maybe actually, should we start with like the name of your book and your pen name?
Yeah, so I did write my story, and I called it Dancing on the Edge of Sanity. And I used the name Anna Claire Rhoads, which is a combination of all the letters in my full name, Sandra Solero, because I was like, well, I kind of want my name in it, but I'm just not ready to put my real name on it yet. So that's where that kind of wacky name and spelling came from.
Thank you, because I assumed it was your name, but I was going by Sandy and it was driving me crazy. There we go.
Yeah.
The obvious answer was there.
And yeah, so I wrote that pretty early in the process of things when I think about where I am now. Because I had postpartum depression and anxiety and intrusive thoughts, and then I had like a year, and then I started writing a book, and then I published the book. And you know, now I'm like, wow, I really just put it all out there. But yeah, so I'll I I'll go back to telling kind of what happened with me in postpartum depression and anxiety. When I was like coming home from the hospital, I knew something wasn't right. I felt really different and really sad and scared, really more scared than sad. And I'd had a lot of information. You know, it's so funny when you hear other stories. I've heard other stories, and there's so much that I can relate to. And then there's other parts where I'm like, wow, I really had a different experience. And one of those is that I felt really well educated about postpartum depression before I had it. I had worked with midwives who kind of, without directly explicitly saying you are a high risk, they had just said, you know, it could happen given your history of anxiety, you know, it could happen. But they also said, you know, but it's a really treatable illness, and it's nothing to be ashamed of. And if it happens, we'll just get you help. So, whereas, you know, I've heard other horror stories of that not being the case.
I loved your midwives, by the way, all the people, your supporting cast.
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
I loved your supporting cast.
Thank you.
Just the women who were there to help you.
Yeah, they were very helpful. And even when the help that I was given wasn't what I needed or what was best, there was a lot of people who really wanted to help me, particularly my midwife. I had a really hard time dealing with some stuff that had happened because when I felt like I'd had, when I expressed to her that I was struggling and stuff, she was wonderful and that she was one of like the people that I was going to, but it was after the fact when I think she wasn't really, she knew about postpartum depression. She didn't really know about postpartum anxiety or OCD. And she was the person who told me I had postpartum psychosis. So that was really scary, but I keep telling the story out of order. Sorry.
That's fine. So I always get the story out of order.
It's hard to be linear. But I was kind of aware that something was going on, wasn't right, and I contacted my midwives, which looking back, I think it's so interesting. I had a counselor. I was working with a counselor. I went to her once a week, and I had been doing that for years. And if someone asked me, like, why I saw a counselor, I'd say, well, I had a history of an eating disorder, and I didn't want, you know, to make those bad choices again. And I had what I considered, like, a stressful job and life. And I had some anxiety. It didn't dawn on me when I was having this sadness and this total fear after my son was born that the person I should be turning to should be my counselor or therapist. I didn't even see it as a mental health thing. It was so wrapped up in birth and having a baby that I really just kept reaching out to my midwife. And they put me on Zoloft, which I began, again, unlike some women who were worried, like, should I take it, should I not take it, or worried about how people might see them. I was just like, something is wrong with me. Yeah, if there's a pill that's going to help me. Like, I also felt pretty confident in my strategies that I had used to deal anxiety in the past. So I work out and I write and I sing and I take time for myself. I had all these tricks, deep breathing, meditation, and none of that was working. And I just knew there's got to be something else that will help me. So I started Zoloft when my son was like 5 days old. And I would say that week was really hard. And I started to feel better. Even though, and I, when I say better, I mean like the next day. My situation again was, for me, it was like an hour to hour situation. It was not this postpartum depression or other illnesses that women have had, and you know, weeks would turn to months and months would turn to half a year. I'm talking like my baby still had like the part of his belly button on him. And I'm like, okay, like every day is a new chance to not cry constantly. And I would have I remember like a really good day, and I write so much about it in my journal. Like today my son latched on well and I felt proud of it, and I didn't just nurse and sleep. I actually washed my hair, and I was applauding myself for those small things. I had a lot of support at my house. My husband was there and my mother was there. And I was really scared because they were leaving, and my mother had been visiting from Florida, and I live in Vermont, and she had to go home. And then my husband was returning to work, and that was happening on the same day. And I think what I had was like a panic attack that sort of lasted an entire day.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't had any caffeine, and I decided to have caffeine, and I feel like that kind of just added to it. And I just had this one day where I tried to sleep and I couldn't sleep. And I was so ashamed that I was so needy, and that for these first 9 days of my son's life, that I hadn't been able to do anything without the help of my husband and my mother. And now they were leaving. And yes, I did. The sad thing is I say they're leaving, and I wasn't completely on my own. Like, more help was coming. My in-laws were coming. But there was going to be, like, a six-hour gap that no one was going to be at my house. And all of a sudden, I started to be very fearful of what might happen. I was afraid that I would not be able to take care of the baby, and the baby would be crying. And honestly, the extent of my fears at first was, what if my son's crying and I can't deal with him crying, so I leave him alone in the bassinet and go in the other room, and I'm crying, and my in-laws arrive and they find me like that. And, you know, I had this image that I wanted to keep up of having it together, and to me that was just like the worst thing imaginable. So I started expressing this fear of, I don't want to be home alone with the baby. And once I said that, my husband, unfortunately, his response just worsened my feelings, because he had never ever really seen me like such a mess. Like, I'd had anxiety in my life before, but again, I managed it with exercise and all sorts of other self-care strategies. And this sort of like paralyzing sitting and just like staring into nothingness and snapping at him, he hadn't really seen that before. And when I said to him, I'm really scared about my mom leaving and you going to work, we need to find someone. I want my mom to stay later and all this stuff. He was really dismissive of my feelings. And I'll never forget the words. You know, he said, you're just going to have to deal with this. You're going to have to be alone with the baby at some point in your life. So you're just going to have to suck it up and deal, kind of thing. And the lack of emotional support was just so painful for me. And that this one day, all of these things just started to like spiral into each other. So not being able to sleep, and my husband's responses, and my mother leaving, I started to have intrusive thoughts. And I'm sure I'd had them before in my life, but this was the time that they were visual intrusive thoughts. And I had talked to my midwife earlier the week, and I had said, you know, I'm taking Zoloft and blah, blah, blah. You know, she had basically said, well, I had two different midwives. One had said to me something that I still think is a really good thing to say to a mom, because when you're struggling like this, you feel so weak and you feel like awful that you need all this help. And one of the things she said to me is, you're doing all the right things for yourself. You're asking for help. You're getting Zoloft. You're having your husband help you. And that just felt really good to hear. And then the other midwife had said stuff to me about, you know, it's okay if you're not feeling, you know, so supported by your husband. Find the support where you can, like get it from your friends. And then she had also said, just let me know if you have any really scary thoughts. You know, and she said, if you ever start thinking about throwing your baby in the fire or drowning the baby, just call me right away. And I had thought, what a weird thing to say, like, you know. And she had also told me about psychosis, and I had also done a lot of reading. I was reading constantly, and everything I read was, it talked about postpartum depression, and it talked about postpartum psychosis. I hadn't found any reading about anxiety or OCD and intrusive thoughts. So,
you know, I'm just feeling like, because we kind of had our experiences like within the same time-ish. And I just feel like, yeah, there wasn't much info out there about anxiety and OCD, because when I started asking Dr. Google, all this stuff would come back about depression and psychosis. And it's like, that's just not feeling like me. So what is going on?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
Yeah.
I hear you. Amen.
Well, and that was exactly it too. I mean, I had all these printouts that said, you know, like 20 things. It was like, lack of sleep, not interested in holding the baby, you know, not interested in previous activities. And I'm thinking, well, I don't know. I had a baby pop out of me like 9 days ago, and I used to love to work out. Now I'm not loving working out, but that's kind of normal, right? But the stuff that, so I didn't relate to everything on that list, and I didn't relate to the stuff about not wanting to hold your baby. I think I was on the other end of it, like I was super protective. You know, part of what was going on, I think, in my head was I just felt like my husband wasn't following the rules enough. You know, like if the doctor said you had to like hold your baby and squeeze its foot for, you know, 3 seconds for some weird reason or whatever, I would have done it. Like I would have followed any weird directions the doctor had given me. And my husband was kind of he's a lot more laid back than I am, which is actually a really, really good thing. But at the time, I was like, you're not taking care of the baby the right way. Therefore, you cannot touch the baby. And I think that also should be recognized as part of that, the whole spectrum of mood disorders, not just not wanting to hold your baby, but being convinced that you're the only one that can do it right.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had, like I said, I'd heard about psychosis. I heard that some stuff that's very scary. And so going back to this one day where the world seemed to be falling apart, I'd been on Zoloft for 4 days. I thought I was getting better. All of a sudden, I started imagining my baby drowning in water. And I didn't really imagine myself doing it, but I just started to see my baby submerged in water. And it was very clear in that, like, the pajamas, like, it was definitely him. It wasn't just some random baby. And that was terrifying. And then the next thing, and these weren't hallucinations, too, because when I first told this to people, they were like, that sounds like hallucinations. And like, when I say first, I mean, like, months later. I mean, I told people about it. Professionals, health professionals immediately, but like friends later on, they were like, are you sure you weren't hallucinating? And I was like, no, I wasn't, because I wasn't, I knew that those weren't normal thoughts, you know? And I also started to imagine my baby in a fire. And I couldn't help but think that, you know, that's what my midwife had said to me. Not that she had planted those thoughts at all, because I don't believe that. But I see that those now are intrusive thoughts, and I know now that my response to them with the heightened anxiety and extreme discomfort were actually signs of how rooted in reality I was. because I knew they were wrong. I knew I didn't want to do those things. I didn't understand why I was having those. And I feel like the best way to explain them to somebody who maybe doesn't get it is, like, you see a horror movie and you hate it and you're trying to get the images out of your mind, but they just keep coming back in.
Yes.
That's exactly what it was like for me. But the problem was that I was then convinced that this meant I was psychotic, and that if I had seen those images, it must mean that I want to do those things, and that I, you know, this wasn't just anxiety or postpartum depression that I was experiencing. This was something really serious, and I was pretty convinced that I was, because I was such a little reader of everything. You know, if you had all these symptoms, you were probably suicidal too. So then I started thinking, without even questioning it, like there was a great deal of like self-talk missing. You know, there was no like rational side of me saying, well, you don't want to do these things, or you're not planning to kill yourself. All I was thinking was, I was like living in that what if brain. And I'm also somebody who really, really turns to friends a lot. And I think part of the illness was that I really believed that I couldn't turn to a friend on this day at that moment. I had a really good friend who would have been happy to help me through this, but she was pregnant and she was due in a month and she already had a child. And I had really believed that it was just too much of me to burden her with my thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, while I was having these thoughts, it was like cold and wintry and I couldn't leave the house and I felt trapped with them. And this was all just in a 24-hour period, and my mind is just going crazy, and it was like I was in prison in my own body. And finally that night, after many attempts to go to sleep, I talked to my mother and I said to her, I am not okay, and I'm really sick, and I'm having these dark thoughts. And I wouldn't tell her what they were. And I said, but, you know, my midwife told me that if I had dark, scary thoughts, I should call her. And I think my mother was terrified out of her mind. So she, like, jumped up and got me the phone. And again, I talked to my midwife, and I told her this, and she said, well, I think you should go back to the hospital. And I thought immediately, I was so excited. I thought, oh, I am going back to the maternity ward where they take care of me. And I had, you know, people had said to me, well, you got to let your husband help and your mother help you. Like, and I was really into breastfeeding. And they were like, you know, people were trying to support me so I could still do that. They're like, well, then just, you know, pump and your mother can, you know, give the baby your milk. But I didn't even know how to use a pump. And I felt like the process of the things that were going through my brain were like, I need to let someone else help me with the baby. In order to do that, I need to pump. In order to pump, I need to learn how to do it. And then it was like suddenly like all this criticism, like, you stupid idiot. How come you didn't learn how to use a pump before? And you know, you were so ill-prepared for this motherhood. Like, you didn't even learn how to use a breast pump. Like, as I'm saying it right now, I'm like, what was so bad about that? But in my head, it was this atrocity that is, like, unspeakable.
Me too. Hand raised. Same beating up about, like, you should have learned how to use the baby sling. You should have learned how to do the breast pump. Like everything. Like, as if you can really practice these things when you're pregnant.
I know, and you know, it's hard. It's really hard to do it ahead of time and to practice things like swaddling a baby and changing a diaper. You kind of just, it's a crash course when that baby arrives. And I'm never really good at doing things the first time because I want to do them so well.
Yes.
I don't even like to call myself a perfectionist because that implies that I'm perfect or close to perfect, you know, like I just say I have really high expectations for myself. And, you know, being a new mother, I gave myself zero room to not be perfect. And I was very hard on myself about quite a lot. And in any case, when I did have this conversation with my midwife, and I said, I called her and I said, I don't know what to do. And she said, well, you could pump and sleep in a different room tonight. And I said, I can't sleep in this house. Like, you're not understanding. Like, it's a small house, small enough that you can hear a screaming baby. My son was screaming too. Like, that was the other weird thing. Like, he wasn't a colicky baby, but he had this day of screaming. So, I thought I was going back to the maternity center, and they would teach me how to use my pumps, and they would check to make sure my breasts weren't cracked, because that was another thing. I was like, not really 100% sure if, you know, I was breastfeeding the right way. And I was, I had a million questions, which of course now I kind of thankfully and luckily forget what they were, but, I went to the hospital pretty willingly, and I didn't go to the hospital where I gave birth because I live 3 minutes away from a hospital, and I gave birth at a hospital an hour away that uses midwives. So this hospital is convenient, but not, it might not have the same level of care. I don't really know how the situation could have been different, but it's midnight on a Saturday night. I'm wearing pajamas. I didn't take my pajamas off. And I show up at the ER, and my husband drove me, and I really didn't even want him to stay. Like, again, looking back at this, I'm thinking, why didn't I tell him to come in with me? Like, I really was kind of ambivalent about should he come with me, should he not? Like, I didn't even, this was my problem. I had to fix it, and I was going to get help. And he needed sleep, too. In my mind, this was, you know, he needed sleep, my mother needed sleep. I was leaving them with a baby, and they were going to have to give this baby formula, and I was going to the ER. And so he just dropped me off at the ER, and I walk in, and I remember going there thinking that they could help me sleep, and also that I had really bad postpartum depression. And I told that but I need sleep. And I was thinking, like, so I was like, let me make sure they know how badly I need sleep. And I'm like, you know, I need sleep. Like, it's, I have postpartum depression, and I need sleep so badly that if I don't get sleep, like, I'm afraid I could. And I'm not even talking, like, in a true, like, from my heart kind of talk. I'm just talking like I had read a manual. So I'm like, you know, I could do self-harm if I don't get enough sleep, because I had read that that's what you do. And I had also, that that's a possibility. And I also had this thought that maybe I could sleep if I took sleeping pills. And then I immediately thought in my head that the only people, like, do sleeping pills really exist? Like, really, do people take sleeping pills, or is that just something that people take if they kill themselves? And the fact that I mentioned them, I was like, oh, suicidal. What if I want to take sleeping pills? So I was kind of confused. And if I was suicidal or not. And I think I might have said that to him. Like, I'm afraid I could be suicidal. Not having the perspective or insight to even know that if you say something like that in an ER or any doctor, like, that's really serious stuff to say. And I certainly wasn't making it up, but it wasn't, to this day, I know that I wasn't suicidal. And the guy, you know, he listened to me, and he took my temperature and he took my pulse, and he asked me if I had a plan. And I have this in my book, and I tell this story all the time. So when he asked me if I had a plan, my response was, yes, my husband is going to see the baby tonight. They're going to get formula. And I might have even been like, so exact, to be like, it's considered to use Similac. And because I had no idea what he meant by plan. And he stopped and he asked again, sort of like, do you have a suicide plan? And I remember thinking, what are you talking about? Of course I don't have a suicide plan. Like, that's why I'm here, because I don't want that to happen to me. Don't you understand? I don't have a suicide plan. I think the interesting thing is, in my fight to try to tell people how truly sane I was, I do think it's very interesting. Like, later on, I was trying to, you know, prove to people that I was sane. It's interesting that I didn't realize at that time why he had asked me that question after what I had just told him, like, a minute ago. And,
you just have me, like, so many ideas in my head, because it's like, we don't, as a society, educate ourselves about mental illness. And so a lot of the time, we don't really learn about it until we're in the thick of it. So it's like, we don't learn how to articulate. Like, I had the same issues with not having an active plan to kill myself, but having had a couple of intrusive thoughts and having them scare the crap out of me. And wanting to be, like, thorough in the information I was giving, and then ending up myself in, like, a higher security unit of the psych ward than I needed. And it's just, like, as soon as you, like, say anything, it's like you trigger, like, oh, the legal liability zone, and now they're just focused on, like, a fixed script and protecting,
right.
their, you know, covering their own ass instead of actually figuring out what was going on with Sandy.
Right.
And
yeah,
it's the middle of the night. Sorry. Keep going.
I loved listening to your story, and you were talking about the different levels. And I unfortunately seem to end up in a building, in a facility that I don't even know if there were different levels, or if there were, I was on the highest security one and I never saw anything else. You know, and I understand that now, and I know more now about that. But, yeah, I didn't know it then, and I just desperately wanted help. And I was kind of scared about why I was seeing my son underwater and imagining him in flames. Like, that really scared me, and I knew that that wasn't really something that I should go around bragging about or, you know, saying. But it really wasn't so much that I was worried how people would perceive me. It was more just because it was just a really awful, awful thing that I had never experienced anything like that in my life. But the guy told me to sit in the waiting room. And as I was in the waiting room, I was writing in my journal about, crazy, I can't believe I'm here. Maybe I should go home. I thought about, this was all a mistake. I should, you know, I probably just need some fresh air. Maybe I'll just walk home. I think I live 2 miles from the hospital, and I thought, well, I don't know, that might just be kind of weird to, like, walk at midnight in my pajamas. You know, I think that's the only thing that kept me from walking back. And
in Vermont in the winter.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it was winter. I think I had a jacket, but yeah, that would have been pretty cold. And I ended up, you know, somebody brought me in, and they brought me in. And I walked past a police officer, and I just thought, that's interesting that there's a police officer north near my door. And it was kind of like a special hallway, and he was there at the hallway, and then that hallway led to 2 different rooms. And I had just kind of thought that he was there probably because the person in the other room maybe was, you know, had done something criminal and also needed medical attention. So I hadn't really thought that he was anything to do with me, this police officer with a gun. And I go into the room, and I realize that the room has, like, no equipment. The only thing in the room was a bed. And I kind of thought that was weird, and I started to think that this must be, like, a special room, and this is because I have postpartum depression. And that kind of scared me and freaked me out, but I was also like, well, said he wanted to sleep, so you probably don't need any medical equipment, so just, like, go to sleep. But I think the thing that was, like, most upsetting about my whole experience was that nobody spoke to me. Nobody sat down and said to me, like, the way I feel like other times doctors do, and I've been lucky enough to have so many positive experiences. Like, my midwife had talked through every possible thing that might happen at my birth. And here I was, like, at the ER, and they bring me to a room, and they just left me there. So I thought, okay, I'm going to sleep, and I'm trying to go to sleep. And then the next thing I know, someone comes in, and they're taking my blood. And then someone else comes in and they're not introducing themselves to me too. There's just all these random people. And I'm truly asking each person who walks in, like, are you going to help me? You know, like, what are you doing? Because they didn't say, like, hi, my name's so-and-so. I'm here to draw your blood. And we're doing that because who knows why. But, you know, they do that for everybody. And they wanted to know if I was on drugs. And no one was talking to me about depression, not being able to sleep. They were just checking all my vitals. And then a doctor came in. And I swear she spent forever on my reflexes. You know, I remember she was like tapping my body in all these weird places. And I talked with her and she finally said something like, well, you know, it sounds like you need some sleep. Maybe we can get you admitted to a medical bed. And I was really excited about that because I thought, wow, like, they'll take care of me and I can sleep. And I also felt a little guilty about that because I really felt like I'm really not sick, you know, and I'm tying up this bed and I'm just here to sleep. That's crazy. And then a person came in who I now know is considered a crisis counselor, but she didn't tell that to me. She just started asking me questions and she was really matter of fact, he didn't have much of a friendly disposition. And I told her every single thing that had been on my mind ever since, like, I gave birth, I started to have postpartum depression, you know, all the stuff that I've probably already just told you, but maybe in shorter. And she left. She was like, okay, I have to go. She kept checking her beeper or pager while she was there, and she didn't say anything to me like, well, you sound sick, well, can I help you with this? She just asked questions, listened, and wrote. And then I know at one point I asked her, like, are you going to help me with postpartum depression? Can you help me with this? And she chuckled and said something like that. And I thought, oh, okay, something like that. And then she left. And I went to sleep, finally. And it also happened to be the weekend that you changed the clocks back. So, I mean, by the time I got there and people asked me questions and stopped asking me questions, I probably was asleep at 1, maybe 2 a.m. And then the police officers, who seemed to switch shifts at, like, 6 or 7 a.m. in the morning, they were really loud, and that woke me up. But it was really like, you know, I had lost an hour. So I don't think I slept that long. And I also was, you know, was fully into breastfeeding. So I had these big, swollen, engorged boobs that needed to be pumped, and I did not use my pump, and I hadn't remembered to bring all of its parts. So I went into the bathroom, and I was like self-expressing. And somebody came in and they said to me, well, you're going to have to stay here. And I couldn't, or no, I'm sorry. Somebody came in and said, we would like you to, it was a new person, someone I hadn't met at all. And she said, well, based on, you know, what you told us last night or whatever, we need to admit you to a hospital and you need to go to this hospital that's like 2 hours away that I'd heard horror stories about. And I was like, I don't want to go there. I don't think I have to go there. I just want to sleep. I want to go home now. And between the doctor and this new person who was like the new crisis counselor, they really persuaded me. It was my choice, but they were like, you're really sick. You really need to do this. And just because you got some sleep right now doesn't mean you're going to get any better. And the other thing that I was told was that I needed to see a psychiatrist and that, you know, I don't know if they had paid attention to the fact that I'd only been on Zoloft for like 4 or 5 days, but they were like, you know, clearly your Zoloft isn't working. You need more and we can't give you anything. And if you want something, you're going to have to get a psychiatrist to give it to you. And if you try to get a psychiatrist appointment around here, you're going to be on a waiting list for 3 months, 3 to 6 months. But if you go to this hospital, a psychiatrist will see you right away. And I feel like that was the selling point. I was like, sweet, like I've never had these images of someone I love underwater. Maybe I do have postpartum psychosis. I better go see a psychiatrist. And so I agreed to go, and then I had to go by ambulance, and I had to strap down, and it was really humiliating. And I feel like, in a nutshell, so I get to this hospital, and it was awful, and they weren't helpful. They didn't know anything about, well, if they knew something about postpartum depression, no one was sharing it with me. Like, no one was giving me strategies or normalizing it for me or talking about anxiety and intrusive thoughts. I was on a locked cell where every 15 minutes I had to be accounted for. And I probably was part, I don't think there was a, there were very few people on this ward that were not heavily medicated, as far as I could see. Like, most people weren't having, like, no one was talking, really. And the few people that were talking really seemed to be struggling with reality. Mm-hmm. And I was one of my, like, my intrusive thoughts was, am I crazy? Like, am I losing my mind? So here I'm like, am I losing my mind? Am I going crazy? And then I see a guy, and I hate to say this, and I hate this about my book that I probably come across in very many negative ways for being so judgmental, but so I'm looking at someone who's wearing clothes that have been drooled on and probably hasn't changed them for days, and he's drooling, and he's mumbling to himself, and I was just like, one part of me was like, I do not belong here, I'm not like that person, and the other part of me was, am I like that, and I just don't know it, and when I tried to express those thoughts to the people who work there, they basically just said to me, you know, everyone thinks that. Everyone thinks they don't need to be here. So I was really confused about where my mental illness was within the spectrum of mental illnesses. And
I totally got the point you were making in the book. And don't worry, because when my book's out there in just like, you know, like another 5 months or hopefully, knock on wood, I'll be saying like the same things, how it's like, here I am looking at people who are dealing with really serious breaks from reality. And mm-hmm. I'm trying to get my mind wrapped around like, what is going on with me? And you've put me in this ward. Am I missing something? Like, am I crazier than I think I was? And I know like we're supposed to be PC about everything, but at the end of the day, if you're struggling with your own mental illnesses, the last thing you need to do is to be thrown into a tank with people who have even more severe mental illnesses and expected that at that stage in your life, you're going to suddenly develop all the skills of like the most well-trained psychiatrist. Like, we're not, I mean, people, we do not pay attention in Los Angeles to the mentally ill homeless on the street. So why are we supposed to like suddenly deal with our own mental illness in that condition? Like, that's just the reality of it.
Yeah.
Thank you for letting me interject my rant.
Yeah, no, of course. I'm really glad to hear that you also kind of had that experience. I've talked to other people who are like, yeah, you know, it was hard to be in a spot like that, but it was really what I needed, or, you know, it helped me. And I, for a really long time, was like, well, I just don't feel like being at that hospital helped me at all. And I'm also, like, I'm a big believer in, like, you know, the first step is just admitting your wrongs and admitting, you know, where your weaknesses are. And I was like, okay, like, do I need to admit that I needed to be there? And I was finally like, no, like, I did need a lot of help, but going there was the wrong choice. And I needed to just kind of accept that and do it in a way that didn't mean I needed to judge people who were there. It just wasn't the right place for me. And if there had been, you know, like a mother-baby unit, I think that probably I would have been a great, great fit for that. Or if they just had, you know, then the other thing too is I wonder, did I just meet like all the staff members that I, because I was only in this hospital for 24 hours. Like, I got there on a Sunday afternoon and I left on a Monday evening. So, you know, maybe I would have had a better experience had I been there longer and been exposed to more things. The other thing that was weird about the stay was I was basically told, like, nothing happens on the weekends. Like, all of their doctors and therapists, they work Monday through Friday. But on the weekends, it's a different level of staff that's there, a different type of staff. And this, to me, this was staff that was just basically telling me, like, you can't have your journal and you can't use your chapstick because of some bizarre rules they had. And, you know, we have to shine a red light in your face every 15 minutes while you're sleeping. And it was all about, like, the rules that I know they have to enforce safety. But there was such a lack of compassion. And even, like, eating, like, I really wanted to eat high protein, relatively healthy food, because I really believed that if I was going to get better, I needed to be, like, nourishing my body with the best possible. And I felt like they were kind of judging me for not eating their fried whatever they gave me to eat. And I remember asking, like, can I just have, like, they had given yogurt at one point. I was like, can I just have, like, 3 yogurts? Like, all I was thinking about was calories and protein grams, like, just get it inside of me. And given my history of having had an eating disorder, which I had already disclosed openly, I feel like the fact that I didn't eat my food there, they were, like, thinking about that, like, oh, looks like she's not eating her food now. And then, you know, like, that's a bad thing. And I actually thought, no, like, what is this fried stuff that you're giving me actually going to do for my body? Because what I think it's going to do for my body is not what's going to help me if I'm trying to approach things, like, holistically. You know, I'm totally 100% on board with taking the loss, but I'm just equally 100% on board in you can't ignore what you put into your body and what you do with your body, and it all works together. So yeah, that was kind of a tangent about food. Sorry.
No, but, it's so necessary. I could talk about this with you for hours. So that's it for this week. Julian is now sitting on the kitchen table pulling pulling apples out of a bag. So I should make this quick. But Sandy's book, if you want to check it out, highly recommend it. Dancing on the Edge of Sanity is available available from Amazon, and I think there's a couple other places, so I will put all of that in the show notes. Show notes are available at ppdadventures.com. You can email me, Courtney@ppdadventures.com. And that's the sound of an apple biting the dust. And oh, he is so pleased with himself. So you can email me, Courtney@ppdadventures.com. If you have questions or comments, or you would like to come be on the show, or you just want to share your favorite recipe for pancakes, or your favorite trick for getting your son to leave you alone for 10 minutes so you can do a podcast episode. But, you know, and there goes another apple. These days are just so quick and precious, and it keeps getting easier every few weeks, I notice. So I'm trying my best to savor it and have a sense of humor. And sometimes apples get thrown off the table during podcast endings. What are you going to do? So don't forget. Okay, I'm going to just stop. Postpartum depression is an incredibly lonely and isolating illness. It is so hard to get out of the house when you have a little one. And it's so hard to get out of the house when you're depressed and or anxious and dealing with a mental illness. So I get it. It's motherhood is tough. Throw in a mental illness and it's just diabolical. So please know, I know how tough it is. I know how lonely, but you are not alone. You did not do anything wrong to bring this on yourself. And you can and will make a full recovery. I hope you have a great week, and I'll see you back here next week for episode 41 and for the second part of the interview with Sandy. Bye.